the issues of groups of people gathering together, which is what unionism is all about, to achieve their common goals, are central to gay men and lesbians today, and are central to the work of unions.
A group of six students, all boys, surrounded me, and they, you know, were yelling names at me, and they were calling me a fag and calling me a homo, and they surrounded me in the parking lot of my school, and they took out a lasso, and they said, let's string up the fag and tie him to the back of our truck and drag him down Mount Rose Highway.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Canada claims procreation defense in marriage equality rebuttal, gay and lesbian workers look for the union label, and the settlement is just the beginning for a harassed gay student. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 21st, 2002. In Canada's continuing struggle over equal marriage rights for gays and lesbians, the government has revealed the basis for its appeal of an Ontario court ruling supporting them. The Justice Ministry's brief to the Provincial Appellate Court describes a core opposite sex requirement for marriage, based on long-held societal views that are rooted in religion, history, and anthropology, in which the fundamental objective of marriage has been the uniting of the two opposite sexes for the purpose of procreation, the raising of children from the marriage, and companionship. The procreation argument ignores a sizable number of both gay and lesbian parents and of infertile heterosexual marriages. The leader of Canada's National Conservative Party, Joe Clark, this week declared his personal belief that rights related to marriage should be available to all individuals, and said he was surprised that the ruling Liberal Party is appealing the Ontario decision. Clark said he would vote to amend federal law to open marriage to same-gender couples, but that his fellow Tories would be allowed to vote their consciences on the issue, since some have a sharply different view.
Events in Canada sparked a warning this week from outgoing Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. George Carey, head of the 70 million-member Global Anglican Communion. Carey specifically criticized the bishop of the Vancouver area New Westminster Diocese, which has voted to celebrate gay and lesbian union ceremonies, as he labeled the denomination's division on gay and lesbian issues a crisis that could lead to schism. Carey was making his farewell address to the Anglican Consultative Council at its triennial meeting in Hong Kong when he described the split between liberals and traditionalists on sexuality issues as his greatest worry. He criticized liberal bishops for local actions contradicting the positions agreed to by an overwhelming majority in the global church, while praising anti-gay conservatives as conscientious clergy. Bishop Michael Ingham questioned the ethics of Carey's remarks and declared that his New Westminster Diocese believes that Christ died for all humanity and that the unity of the church cannot be built on unjust discrimination against minorities such as homosexual Christians. I regret that the Archbishop's remarks will confirm and deepen the impression that he has not heard the cry of these, his own children in the church. Until all voices are heard, the unity we all seek will remain elusive.
While the Church of England may be troubled by gay and lesbian relationships, secular Britain seems increasingly ready to recognize them. This week, the Leeds City Council agreed to create the UK's fourth domestic partnership registry and the first in Yorkshire. Unmarried couples, regardless of gender, will be able to register their relationships beginning in January, although it will not bring them any legal status.
In Australia, sweeping equality reforms, including recognition of same-gender couples that were approved in the state of West Australia last year, finally went into effect with a proclamation this week. West Australia had been lagging woefully behind most of the nation in age of consent and civil rights protections, but is now a leader on parenting and partnership issues. Not resting on its laurels with the success of those controversial reforms, West Australia's Australian Labor Party government last week introduced another omnibus bill to update and equalize more than 70 state laws affecting relationships, notably extending gay and lesbian couples' rights to compensation for a partner's injury or death and giving them spousal status with respect to medical treatment. Attorney General Jim McGinty said the measure would also treat so-called de facto couples like married ones with respect to such corporate issues as financial disclosure, land tax assessments, and eligibility for related government benefits.
While Peru's Congress has opened debate on amending the national constitution, with activists lobbying hard to add explicit civil rights protections for gays and lesbians, students at Lima's Pontifical Catholic University are protesting an anti-gay pamphlet the school is distributing. The booklet, entitled Sexual Identity, Is It Possible to Choose?, describes homosexuality as a curable illness, with celibacy the only healthy option for those gays or lesbians who won't or can't change. The document was prepared and distributed at the request of University Chancellor Cardinal Juan Luis Cipriani, Archbishop of Lima, but even the Catholic University Student Federation condemned it as violating individual liberties and personal dignity. There are also reports that literature distributed by the school's counseling center that failed to describe homosexuality as an aberration has been removed.
Iran's government has moved to censor a book considering homosexual themes in historic Persian literature. Even though author Cyrus Shamiza's book Shahedbazi, Witness Play, won initial approval from the Ministry of Culture, this week the judiciary ordered the publisher to collect all copies and stop its sale.
But in the U.S., there was a free speech victory this week for Oklahoma City gays and lesbians. The Cimarron Alliance Foundation sued the city last year when its application to hang Gay and Lesbian History Month banners on city lampposts was denied under an ordinance against using that medium for social advocacy. The ordinance had been enacted after the city received complaints about 2001 gay and lesbian pride parade banners. This week, a federal court struck down the ordinance as overly vague and an infringement on free speech, and found that Cimarron is entitled to both damages and court costs to be paid by Oklahoma City.
Another U.S. federal court issued a blow to transgenders this week in the closely watched case of a heterosexual Louisiana man fired by grocery giant Winn-Dixie for occasional cross-dressing outside working hours. The case of Peter Euler had seemed particularly clear-cut because of his exemplary work record, even when Dixie did not contest that it was solely his personal life that led to his termination. But U.S. District Judge Lance Affrick found that federal laws prohibiting discrimination based on sex do not protect transgenders, citing 31 failed attempts in Congress to amend the law to cover sexual orientation. The American Civil Liberties Union, representing Euler, cited 15 years of court rulings viewing the civil rights law as prohibiting discrimination based on nonconformity with gender stereotypes. And Euler noted that Winn-Dixie had not fired three women who wore male clothing at work. But to the judge, the women's situation was different since they did not impersonate men, adopt masculine personas, or have gender identity disorders. He wrote that this is not just a matter of an employee of one sex exhibiting characteristics associated with the opposite sex. This is a matter of a person of one sex assuming the role of the person of the opposite sex. The ACLU is still considering whether to file an appeal.
The Ohio Supreme Court gave a final rejection this week to an attempt to repeal at the ballot box domestic partner health benefits for gay and lesbian city workers in Cleveland Heights, the first city in the state to extend those benefits. The state's high court found unanimously that benefits opponents had failed to meet the city's requirement for signatures on a petition to place a repeal measure on the November ballot.
While that leaves some gay and lesbian activists sighing with relief at one less referendum to fight in November, others are sighing with regret at results of some votes last week. Arizona State Representative Steve May, who gained national visibility as both a high-ranking openly gay Republican elected official and as a high-profile victim of the military's so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, has officially lost his party's primary election by a scant 58 votes. Redistricting had put him in the unusual situation of opposing two fellow Republican incumbents.
And finally, New York songwriter-producer Larry Dvoskin is out to create the first openly gay male country music star. He's put out a call for men ages 18 to 26 to join his Today's the Future talent search, promising to launch the winner's career by producing his debut album. Dvoskin has the chops to make a star, having written songs for top names in pop and rock that over the last 3 years have garnered 3 Grammy nominations, 4 number one rankings, and sales of 10 million copies. While K.D. Lang may have been the first star in the genre to come out, Dvoskin said, "Lesbians are cool, but a gay male isn't. There are already major male country stars that are gay, but none dare to come out due to fear of the reaction." He himself expected a firestorm in response to his announcement, but instead described reactions as overwhelmingly enthusiastic. Dvoskin declared that it is time for a great leap of progress in country music. This will push the culture forward. So if you think you have the extraordinary voice and musical ability Dvoskin is looking for and feel ready to withstand what he calls substantial scrutiny, send your email to him at todayisthefuture@aol.com.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 21st, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
They took out the lasso and they got it around my neck three times. I was able, luckily, to get it off all three times. Had they been any better at lassoing, I really don't think that I would be here.
It's the kind of story that could easily have had a tragic ending if not for the determination of a young gay man who refused to take harassment lying down. You'll hear about his landmark legal case and what he's doing now later in the program. Despite the difficulties some trade unions have had in recognizing the fact, the issues of concern to organized workers have a lot in common with the issues raised by the movement for lesbian, gay, bi, and trans rights. Those commonalities are at the heart of the Workers Out Second World Conference of Lesbian and Gay Trade Unionists, scheduled in conjunction with the 2002 Gay Games in Sydney, Australia. This Way Out correspondent Michael Schembri raised some of the questions that will be on the table with Organizing Committee Vice President Mark Dolahenty.
I think the issues for gay men and lesbians, for transgender people, for intersex people, for the whole gamut of people that we might like to call queer these days, their issues of discrimination, of violence, of all sorts of oppression are the issues that unions have traditionally taken up on behalf of their members. So, for example, at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, the issues often focused around working class people, particularly around women. Many of those issues are now resolved, although there is still much more work to do. But, of course, for gay men and for lesbians, the issues of discrimination are still there. We have legislation that is meant to protect us. We have agreements in effect. We have policy. We have government people speaking out. But every day, gay men and lesbians are still beaten up. Gay men and lesbians still suffer discrimination in the workplace. We suffer homophobia, bigotry, and violence. So the issues of groups of people gathering together, which is what unionism is all about, to achieve their common goals, are central to gay men and lesbians today and are central to the work of unions.
So would you say in that case that even legislation is not enough, but that an active unionism on the shop floor is the only way to ensure that discrimination doesn't happen?
I see them as two parts of one weapon. Laws are there, but we know they're broken all the time. You've only got to read in the paper about people who suffer discrimination, about people who suffer violence. We've seen in the gay press lately that hate crimes, hate murders are still happening. So while the laws are there, unions need to ensure that in the areas that we have members, that those laws are observed.
Now, in fact, we know that there is a lot of homophobia and bigotry inside the unions, up to the top layers, in fact. What can be done about that?
Sometimes the union is the enemy, but the way to change that is not to, be outside the tent pissing in, but to be inside the tent and working for change all the time. So that in my own union, the National Tertiary Education Union, we now have a caucus of gay men, bisexual, transgender, lesbians, called Queer Unionists in Tertiary Education, or CUTE, and we work within our union structures to change opinions that are outmoded and that are bad.
On the international scene, what role have unions and gay and lesbian activists within unions played?
One of the great strengths, I think, of unionism is that we are able to reach out to sister organisations in other countries. Generally, that started, of course, in the westernised nations where unionism had its origins. But as unionism has spread more and more into, for example, Southeast Asia, into East Asia, into Africa, into the Pacific, those ties that unions have with each other are able to translate into the issues that gay men and lesbians have in the more prosperous nations. Those issues that we're fighting for are able then to be translated across into the areas where unionism isn't quite so strong, and is yet another reason, I suppose, in some of those countries where people get beaten up and killed all the time. It's bad enough in those nations that unionists are beaten up and killed, but for gay and lesbian unionists, there's the double whammy. So what we do is we try and keep contacts with them. We send them resources. We invite them over here to provide them with solidarity, to provide them with our support, so that the struggle they're facing in places like Indonesia or the Philippines or Thailand, where there are fairly strong union movements, so that the issues that the gay and lesbian members of unions there face are able to be supported and, we hope, encouraged by our efforts in the westernised nations.
And I guess that's exactly where Workers Out comes in, isn't it?
Absolutely right. This is the second World Conference of Gay and Lesbian Trade Unionists. The first was held in Amsterdam at the last Gay Games. This time around, of course, it's in Sydney, and the focus is on Asia, Southeast Asia, and the Pacific, so that we're particularly encouraging people to come from places like Papua New Guinea, from the Philippines, from Thailand. We've got people coming from Vietnam. We've got people coming from Japan. Of course, we have people on the other side of the Pacific coming from Canada, from the United States, from Mexico, from South America. We've got a good organising committee that's been going now for about 2 years, and we have well over 100 people who've registered so far, and we've had several hundred expressions of interest. The opening speaker at the first plenary will be Sharon Burrow, who is the president of the Australian Council of Trade Unions. So we think that demonstrates that unions are taking gay and lesbian issues very seriously when the head of the union movement in Australia is coming to open our conference.
What outcomes do you hope for?
Encouragement for those people who are in unions to speak out about gay and lesbian issues all the time. We are particularly hopeful that we will be able to establish strong networks for our comrades in Southeast Asia and the Pacific, so that their issues can be progressed, so that they know that they're not alone. And we also hope we have a bloody good time.
That was Michael Schembri in Sydney, Australia, talking with Mark Dolahenty, Vice President of the Organizing Committee of the Workers Out Second World Conference of Lesbian and Gay Trade Unionists. The event is being held in conjunction with the 2002 Gay Games, and for more information online, you can check out www.workersout.com.
We were out in the country, spreading our wings wild and free, learning about life from Mother Nature, doing what comes naturally.
Howdy, I'm Doug Stevens.
And we're the Out Band,
the official gay and lesbian ambassadors of country music.
And you're listening to
This Way Out, the international
lesbian
and gay magazine.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way someday.
It's impossible to estimate how many times a day, every day, all over the world, a gay or lesbian kid endures verbal or physical harassment at school. But individually and in groups, queer students and their supporters are fighting back, and some of them are winning and winning big. In a Reno, Nevada lawsuit filed by the Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund, a U.S. federal court judge recently awarded nearly $500,000 to a gay student who was continuously harassed while his school district did nothing to stop it. This Way Out's Brian Goble caught up with now 21-year-old San Francisco resident Derek Henkel.
We lived about 45 minutes outside of Reno, and I went to high school in Reno.
Derek Henkel grew up in a city that likes to call itself the biggest little city in the world.
It's an industry-driven town. It's driven by the gaming industry. And the gaming industry really goes to this kind of heterosexist mentality. It's really based on the heterosexual male, actually, that's over the age of 21. So I think that there are a lot of ageism issues that come out of that. There's certainly a lot of sexism issues for women and for lesbians and for, you know, anyone who doesn't identify as a traditional gender that come out of that. And I think that another thing that really comes out of Reno is this kind of idea that people are valued in different ways. And what was really clear was when I came out that my life wasn't valued.
Derek didn't even know he was gay when he was a little boy, but he knew something was up. Kids at school knew it too.
Because I was an effeminate kid, kids would call me a sissy, and you know, and that was kind of the terminology. I would ride the bus in the morning for 45 minutes, so I would have to get on the bus, and there was just daily taunts, and as soon as I got on the bus, no one wanted to sit next to me. If there wasn't an open seat, it would be a big deal. If I sat next to someone, it was, you know, this insane thing, getting on the bus in the morning, and so I would play Erasure, actually, and blast music and gay music at that, trying to kind of drown out the epithets.
At what point did the harassment actually become physical?
When I was in sixth grade, the largest boy in school held me down while they forced a girl to kiss me. Which, you know, I don't necessarily know that I don't think that they knew that I was gay and that I liked boys, but they just kind of saw me as kind of an effeminate boy and wanted to make me tougher. And so that was one of the ways that they did it.
Derek came out to his parents when he was 12 years old. He tried to tell them about all the incidents in school. At the age of 14, you might find it hard to believe that after coming out to his parents and enduring a life of harassment in elementary and middle school, the worst was yet to come for Derek. Some of the kids who harassed him were punished. High school would be another story.
Right after I came out of the closet, it was only, you know, a matter of a week or two after I came out, and I was walking back from lunch, and I was in the middle of my school parking lot, and a group of six students, all boys, surrounded me. And they, you know, were yelling names at me, and they were calling me a fag and calling me a homo, and they surrounded me in the parking lot of my school, and they took out a lasso, and they said, let's string up the fag and tie him to the back of our truck and drag him down Mount Rose Highway. They took out the lasso, and they got it around my neck three times. And I was able, luckily, to get it off all three times. Had they been any better at lassoing, I really don't think that I would be here.
Derek was able to get away. Even while he was running, the group of boys was still chasing after him, trying to lasso him. Finally, he found a teacher and was able to call the vice principal for help. But help isn't exactly what you'd call it.
It took three calls in an hour and 45 minutes for them to respond to me. And once she got there, she came into the room and she was like, you know, what's so urgent? And I was, you know, hysterical. And I said to her, they tried to throw a neck around my rope. And she laughed at me for not being able to speak correctly and made a joke with the substitute teacher. And then 15 minutes later, at the end of the school day, sent me home on a bus and said, we'll deal with it in the morning.
Nothing really happened to Derek the next morning. In fact, none of the students involved in the attack was given any kind of disciplinary action. It would become a pattern for Derek. School was a violent atmosphere. Derek's cries for help fell on deaf ears.
Everyone that I ran into would harass me because it became the cool thing to beat up on the gay kid. And because my administration didn't punish anyone, it became completely okay. I remember crying and sitting like at the side of the principal's desk, like on the floor, just shaking. And she came in and she's like, what's wrong? And I said, you need to do something about this. I can't go to school here anymore. Like, I can't be here. Like, people are, you know, trying to kill me.
Eventually, Derek was transferred to an alternative education school, then another school with conditions.
My transfers were conditioned upon me remaining in the closet. And I was told that sexuality was a bedroom matter and not a classroom matter, and that if I, you know, I could go to school, but I was not to talk about being gay.
At the age of 17, Derek finally decided to move. He'd had enough and felt he was being denied an education. He went to Atlanta, and his life changed forever. He discovered other gay youth and became a volunteer and an activist. Ever since then, Derek has been speaking out.
It's really sad to me that my peers, and myself included, have a 3 times higher dropout rate than heterosexual students. And I think that that is alarming when you consider that we make up only 10% of that student populace. It's a very, very hard thing to go from being abused in school and dropping out to going to college. And because of that, we see a third of our community not being educated and not having access to higher education. And I'm really scared about what that means for the future of our movement. I'm also really scared for what that means for those kids, because you have this generation of kids that are flipping burgers, that are thinking that's all their lives will ever be able to achieve, and then they're putting guns in their mouths, or they're, you know, overdosing on drugs, or they're doing things to their body that are so negative and so horrible because of the stigma that they've had to face on their high school campuses.
Derek has been doing more than just speaking out. Recently, he won a $450,000 settlement against the Washoe County School District in Reno, Nevada. The ruling affirms a gay or lesbian student's First Amendment right to be themselves on campus. The district has also been forced to make policy changes that protect gay and lesbian students.
What that says expressly is that no other student in that district will be harassed in the way that I was, or be allowed to be harassed in the way that I was. 85% of my peers are harassed on a daily basis in this country. 46% are physically assaulted on a regular basis. And of that, very few teachers intervene. So I think that, you know, my answer to this problem when I'm talking to gay kids is that they need to know their rights. They need to know that they absolutely are okay, first of all. And that, second of all, that they absolutely have the right to go to school, and that going to school in fear is not the way that they need to be going to school.
Derek lives in San Francisco now, a city he's grown quite comfortable in. He's helping to launch a public service campaign to educate gay and lesbian students across the country. Even though he won a landmark lawsuit, and even though his school district has made changes, one thing he never got from any of the schools was an apology. For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goebel in San Francisco.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, Michael Schembri, and Brian Goebel contributed program material. Thanks also to Paul Jaffe. The Sydney Trade Union Choir, David Brown, Erasure, Kruder and Dorfmeister, and Mogwai performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening on WGDR Plainfield, Vermont, 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, KEOS College Station, Texas, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.